Last month, I gave a sermon on wisdom. We talked about some of the different kinds of wisdom that the Bible tells us about, compared them, contrasted them, looked at which one of those was optimum for us to base our life on and try to have in our life. And this sermon is, in some ways, kind of a continuation of that message. There are books in the Bible that are actually called books of wisdom or the wisdom books that if any of us are actually looking, searching for godly wisdom, there are places that we should refer to, places that we should go looking, and we should include the study of those books in our study fairly regularly. Psalms, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes are called wisdom books. And they are different in many ways from the other books and the way they're organized, how they're written, and the way that the information is presented in those. And what we're going to do today is a survey of one of those. And it will be a survey because there's no way that we can read any of those in their entirety and look at every scripture in there. But what I have tried to do is pick out verses that we'll read and we'll look at that are highlights, kind of major turning points, or when major themes in that book are presented, that we'll look at those. And just like with every message and any time you're studying, if this interests you, it's certainly something where you could go and study this book on your own and get more than what we'll get today. Hopefully this will be more of an effort to wet your tongue and to be reminded of some wisdom that's given to us in that book. The book that we're going to look at today is Ecclesiastes. It's completely Solomon's book, and certainly one of the wisest men that ever lived, if you believe God. There's a lot of lessons in that book. And over the years, I've read Ecclesiastes a number of times. And I wouldn't try to count how many times I've read most of it or large parts of it. But what has struck me in this last time when I looked at it again, at every age in my life, I was able to find some part of it that really kind of resonated with what was happening in my life. And I think it's the way that it's presented. Solomon writes looking back on his history for the most part. He writes about what happened in his past, and then he explains how he felt, which I think is why it could resonate with different age groups. And whether that was good or bad, what he learned from the things that he did, and he tried to share those with us. So it's a good book. It's a book of, really it describes a process of discovery for him. Discovering that where he started in his life and where he thought it would go and how it went wasn't, even for him, it wasn't what he expected. His life was different than what he expected. So I find it a very interesting book. It starts after some of the first things we know about Solomon. We know that he asked God for wisdom. That God gave him the opportunity to ask for anything when he was succeeding David as ruler of Israel. And because of what he asked for, God blessed him. And things started out great for him. I mean, he had, we see those early years of some of those early statements. He had the right attitude. He had the right ideas. He had the right focus. He knew who he needed to look to be successful in life, truly successful. But then, he became lost. Even with all that wisdom, he became lost. And this Ecclesiastes doesn't really tell the early story as much as it tells what happened during that time that he was lost. And then how he, how he ended up. What brought him back, I guess. So that in the end, he's, and this is written near the end of his life. At the end of his life, he can see that he got back to where he needed to be, but it wasn't always an easy process for him to do that. So there's a lot of lessons in Ecclesiastes, and I hope that we'll get some of those today, that all each one of us find some value in some of the things we're going to look at. I'd like to start at the beginning of the book, and we're going to read all of the first chapter and talk about different things, because it sets up what he's trying to accomplish and gives us an idea of where he's going with everything. So Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Preacher is the way it's translated, at least in the New King James Version. But that's not necessarily accurate. It's not complete. The Hebrew word actually has more of the sense of someone who is a teacher or someone who calls people to assembly. He's calling attention to the message that he's trying to present, and he's acting as a teacher, calling to an assembly. In many ways, it is a written sermon to an assembly, to whoever God assembles to read this message. He jumps right into his idea in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Pretty pessimistic. And that's where he was at one time in his life. Futility, or futile is another translation of those words, vanity. Worthless, futile. Nothing has any point. Nothing. There's nothing that I can do that makes a difference. Nothing that will have any lasting impact. Very pessimistic. And it was based on that time in his life when he lost his way and the attitude that he had during that time, which actually led him to do some pretty stupid things when he's looked back at it and when you see what he did. But he's speaking from a very human perspective. And say, we humans, what are we struggling for? It's all pointless. It's all pointless. Then let's continue reading. I will read verses 3 through 8 as a straight shot and then talk a little bit about those. What profit has a man from all of his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south and turns around to the north, and it circuits continually, or whirls continually and comes again in its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea. Yet the sea is not full to the place where the rivers come, but they return again. Everything is full of labor, or everything is hard. Everything I try to do, everything a man tries to do is hard. It's tiring. Man cannot express how hard it is. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. And we'll read more about the development of this attitude as we go into the book, but it's someone who's kind of just fed up with life. That doesn't see any point to life at all. And one of the things that I really started to look at this time when I was reading it through was, can you really see when Solomon's attitude changes? When his wisdom took him in the wrong direction, or it was his wisdom and not God's wisdom, but when he went in the wrong direction. Because obviously this attitude wasn't his attitude at the start of his reign, but he got to the point where he didn't see any value in human life, didn't see any value in living at all. And I do think there's some resonation, that can resonate with all of us at different times in our lives, that it's hard to say, sometimes you say, what's the purpose? Why am I fighting? Why am I doing this? What's the value? I try hard to do something or another, and it doesn't work out. Or I've been doing this for 40 years, and I'm just tired. And it's interesting, and I think in some ways it can be helpful if you look at it properly, to realize that you aren't the only one. I mean, someone who had everything, had all that Solomon had, still got to that same point in his life for a period where he said, what's it all about? What's it worth? I don't see any value to things. And he says in verse 9, that which has been is what it will be, and that which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. There isn't anything that I can come up with that's new and genuine that someone else hasn't thought of. I can't make a contribution. I can't do anything because somebody else has already thought of it. All my efforts, it doesn't matter how smart I am, how talented I am, how many people I have working for them, somebody else has already thought of it. So it's all pointless. I mean, very, 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 very negative about life when he felt these things. Verse 10, is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us, and there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after. To some degree, it's someone who's thinking about his legacy. How am I going to be remembered in history? Is anybody even going to know anything about me after I'm gone? And again, you'd think with Solomon that wouldn't be something that you'd really consider a problem, that everyone would forget about you, but he probably had examples of that in his life. Egypt was around, and even at that time, Egypt was strong, but, you know, you go a few generations and you forget emperors and you forget people who did things, and there's stuff, there are things that the monuments they built get buried in the sand, and he was concerned about whether he had made an impact, that he would be remembered. And again, I think it's natural for men and women, all of us, as you get older, to wonder about that. What am I leaving behind that's of any value? What have I done? What have I done with my life that makes it worthwhile? Have I used my life in a way that was right and was good? Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. So again, he's talking in the past tense. This is not from where he ends up when he wrote this book, but where he was at one time in his life. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man by which they may be exercised or may be trained or may be disciplined or they may learn. Verse 14, I've seen all of the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for wind. I've looked at what other people did. He had access to history. He had access to things that had happened in the past. I've looked at things that other people have done, and it's vanity. It was futile. It was pointless, grasping after the wind. Verse 15, that what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. And I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceived that this was also grasping for the wind. For in much wisdom is grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And verse 17 is one of those places where, again, as I was looking at it this time, maybe that was the wrong turn that he made. He didn't just search after wisdom, set his heart to understand wisdom, but he set his heart to understand madness and folly. He said, to understand those things, and again, we have more of the story later on in this book. He didn't just look for it through head knowledge. He experienced it. He immersed himself in madness and folly. And I wonder if that decision wasn't, at the start of what took him in the wrong direction. Because he wasn't content He wasn't content with the wisdom that God had given him. He recognized this. I mean, here he says, I've been given this. But you don't hear a lot of, even here, you don't see a lot of reference to God in all of this. It's a lot of what he did and what he had. And he lost that focus in God and started to think an awful lot of himself because he was successful. Israel became as wealthy as it had ever been under his reign. There was so much wealth that they didn't know what to do with it. It became more powerful than it ever had in any other time. And he could do whatever he wanted, try whatever he wanted. He wasn't challenged in any way. And Israel was at peace, so there weren't wars. So he let success get to his head. And he let success, he began to think that his success was because of who he was. And lost sight of God. And you can see that in these statements, and as we go over more of it, you'll see that. And again, a lesson for all of us. It isn't just in suffering that Satan tries to pull us away from God and tries to make us stand on our own when we're in trials. Satan will use success to take us away from God too if we're not on guard. And he did use Solomon's success to take Solomon and separate Solomon from God for a time. Now let's go to chapter 2. We'll skip a few verses here. I'd just like to read verse 3 because it's really kind of when Solomon establishes the experiment that he was going to do. Chapter 2, verse 3. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom. So he tried to have both. You know, I'm going to try to satisfy the flesh, every desire, but still hold on to that wisdom while guiding my heart and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. You can almost see Satan working in his mind. You know, the same way he kind of worked with Christ. Solomon had wisdom. Solomon was looking to God. He was going in the right direction, and he had success. And then he said, well, maybe there's more yet. Maybe there's a little more for you than just wisdom and success and looking to God. Maybe there's something too. All this folly, or you know, all this satisfying the flesh that I see other leaders of the world doing, other people wanting to do, and he started to experiment, and it was a poor choice of things to do. We have at least a record of what he did to show us, but he indulged in, as he said, the pleasures of the flesh to see if they would give him happiness, because again. Somewhere along the line, Satan got him to think in his mind, this success that God has given me isn't enough. I want something more. He was convinced there's something missing in my life, some happiness that I don't have right now, that if I just try these other things, maybe I would find it. He's at the pinnacle of, and everywhere he looks are blessings from God and success that came from God, and he gets in his mind, I'm missing something. There's this hole that I need to fill. Pretty amazing that could happen to him. And verses 4 through 8 tell some of the things that he tried. I'm not going to read them all. I think we have a general idea. But he says in verse 9, so I became great and excelled more than all of those who were before me, and my wisdom still remained with me. He believed at least that his wisdom remained with him. But again, I do think it's interesting, especially in light of the sermon that we had where we talked about wisdom, that he always says, my wisdom remained with me. He isn't really saying God's wisdom remained with me. The way he was acting was out of a humanistic type of wisdom. So he said, my wisdom still stayed with me. I was still pretty smart on human terms, as far as human terms were going. In verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. My heart rejoiced in all of my labor. This was my reward for all of my labor. Again, Satan's influence right there. he was doing all of these fleshly, lustful things, and you know, for a little time at least, he said, "All right, this is what I deserve for all the hard work I put in. This is what, anything I want, any way that I want to satisfy my flesh. Now I get it. Now there's meaning in my life. Now I'm getting something back for all of the work that I have done." And we're not Solomon, we're not King of Israel, but that attitude of not being contented with God's blessings, not being contented with what God gives us and how He looks after us, and thinking that if we just cheat a little bit, maybe there's more, can happen to all of us. That desire for something more than what God provides for us, that we think of our own, you know, strength, beliefs, intelligence, whatever, we can get more, and that's really what we deserve. So again, just a lot of life lessons and how to approach our life and not to allow Satan to get that foothold in is a lot of what you see in these first chapters of Ecclesiastes. You see someone who was far above all of us, brought down lower than any one of us right now, because of allowing Satan to influence him into making the wrong decisions and heading down the wrong path. Verse 11, "Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and all the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for wind, and there was no profit under the sun." So that belief that he'd gotten what he deserved, this is finally, it didn't last long. And that's the way with all of the human things, all of the fleshly things that Satan throws at us that he offers to us. It may be something that really satisfies you. You may feel like you've got the rest, you know, the peace, the whatever that you need. And yet it's short-lived. If it's not from God, it doesn't last long. And then you see, well, that was stupid. That was a waste of time. Why did I ever do that? Why did I think that was going to be a good thing? And Solomon had that same process as well. We'll skip a few verses here. We're going to skip down to verse 17. 12 through 16, he's really... He's making some comparisons between wise and foolish people, and again, there's value in those, but I have to jump somewhere or you'll be here for 3 hours or longer. So, I'd like to go to verses 17 and 18 next. "Therefore, I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for it was all futile, vanity, grasping for wind. And I hated all the work that I had done under the sun, because I have to leave whatever I do to someone who comes after me." So again, you can see someone who's looking for a legacy. And he's saying, any work that I do, it's not going to be, "Oh, Solomon did that. I don't take it anywhere with me after I die. I'm building all this up and somebody else is going to reap the benefits of it. It doesn't do me any good." You know, it's still pretty self-centered. "All this work doesn't do me any lasting good. I'm just leaving it for somebody else when it's all done." But really, he didn't have satisfaction. You know, you still see in his life, he's trying all of these things, and you see that it doesn't give him satisfaction. And he's even recognizing that it really didn't give him satisfaction, the things that he was doing, the things that he was trying. But it is a good lesson that he recognized, and we should recognize, and I think we do in general, but how we apply it in our life is always the hard part. You know, the lasting greatness doesn't come from the things we built. The physical things that we put together, companies we were part of, none of those lasting greatness doesn't come from those things. It doesn't come from physical things. Well, let's skip down to verse 26. For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in God's sight. But to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting that he may give to him who is good before God. This is also vanity and grasping for wind. And this isn't the greatest translation. I've read through a number of different translations, and essentially what it really is saying is, from God, you get wisdom, you get knowledge, you get joy. From seeking after wealth, gathering and collecting things, you just get futility. It's vanity. Wisdom, knowledge, joy comes from God. The sinner, the man who's going against God, who isn't have God a part of his life, who's searching after wealth and gathering and collecting things, all they get in the end is futility. Now we'll just jump a few verses. We're going into chapter 3. We'll skip the first 8 verses because all of you have heard the song. Time and a purpose for everything. So you know the gist of it. But it talks about it different times for different things in your life. Verse 9 says, he writes, what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are occupied. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. He's asking, kind of repeating the same question, what do people get from their hard work? Is there something greater than that? Is there something greater, something of more value? What do you get from your hard work? And he says, look, and then he looks at what God creates, and he sees beauty in God's plan. And he sees that God, the things that God do and how God does those aren't really something that man can understand. We can't see the beginning from the end of it. And I look at all of this writing as kind of him explaining his thought progression as he's going through this time. And I don't have a clue whether it was 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years of his life. I don't know how long he was separated from God, and I don't think we really have any record of how long that lasted. But he's kind of showing how his thoughts changed. He's starting to think about God again and recognize that there's something more than maybe than what he can accomplish himself and what he can experience himself. So we're going to make a fairly large skip. We're going to jump past chapter 4. Again, not that there isn't things of value to read there, but it's more of a side point that he's making in chapter 4 than the main focus of what he's been talking about. So we'll jump to chapter 5 and begin in verse 1. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil. So again, this is the teacher, and he's talking, and we start to see God coming back more into the picture of his life. And he's saying, be careful on how you approach God. That it's important to recognize that when you walk into the house of God, you're walking into something different than somebody else's house. Another room in your and just a normal room that you're coming before God. And he also makes an interesting point that he says, go there to hear rather than to give the sacrifices of fools. He's saying when you go to God's house, your focus ought to be to hear what's being said, hear what's being, however God's communicating to you. And, he's talking about a temple. I couldn't tell you right now if Solomon's temple has actually been built at this point. Probably it was, but he's certainly saying when you go to where God is, go there with a different attitude. Recognize that something is different. This isn't like every other event that you do in your life. Verse 2, do not be rash with your mouth, but let your heart utter anything hastily before God. For God is in heaven and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. Again, the advice of the teacher. Go to God to listen. Don't go to talk. Don't go to tell God how everything should be. Try to listen to God when you're in his presence. And that's whether you're at church or you're in prayer or you're in study. For us, anytime you go before God, don't try to direct God in the direction you want him to go, but try to listen to what God has to say and hear what he has to say and approach it that way. And the results will be better. Again, a great wisdom. Just points that we all should consider. God is God and we are not God. And he's recognizing again, he's recognizing that I'm not God. And there's a difference between he and I. Even though I have all this power and wealth and everything else, he's acknowledging now, starting to acknowledge, well, there is a God there and he is higher than me. Maybe there's something that I've lost. And I'm just going to read a couple verses in chapter 5, a couple more verses in chapter 5. I will say that verses 3 through 7, if you read those, it talks about the danger of being foolish before God. And that's a good thing for us to read every once in a while, to remind ourselves that it is possible to be foolish when you go before God. And to just think about how we approach prayer, how we approach study, and go with the proper attitude in those things. But I'd like to read verses 18 and 19 in this chapter now. He says, here's what I've seen. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all of his labor, in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life, which God gives him, for it is his heritage. So again, I think it's an indication that he's starting to come back to God. Recognize that heritage comes from God, not from something that any of us do. For as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labors, this is a gift from God. The gift from God. This is what God intends for us to enjoy blessings. God doesn't intend for us to never be blessed, to always have to suffer. What Solomon is saying is the important thing to remember, because I forgot it, is that all those blessings come from God. That the success that we have comes from God. But you can read the start of this and get the idea that God is giving us the message. Don't enjoy life. It's pointless. Don't enjoy things. Don't smile. Just make your way through it, because that's all that it's worth. And Solomon comes back, and as his mind gets better, he recognizes that's not what God wants either. God wants us to enjoy the blessings that he's given us. And he's given us a lot of blessings. But it's important to remember where the blessings come from. Satan's greatest weakness was his vanity. It's what got him in the wrong path. That belief that he was more than what he was. And vanity is what got Solomon in trouble. And vanity can get all of us in trouble too. And we can feel like we're the most humble person in the world. And yet, there are times and things and instances where vanity can still be something that leads us in the wrong direction. Because it's actually more of a weakness in some ways. If you think you're worthless, you're going to find something that you think gives you value, makes you worth something. And that's going to become really important to you. And you're going to, when you get better at it, that's when vanity starts to come in. So it can hit us. It can hit any one of us. And again, that's one of the lessons from Ecclesiastes, is that vanity can get anyone. Even someone who had, whether you're someone that has apparently everything or someone that apparently has nothing. Alright, we're going to skip chapter 6 as well. Goes through, I mean, look at in my book it has a lot of subheadings, but it's talking about things that don't give you any satisfaction, any lasting satisfaction. And again, you could read those, there's not any problem with that. Start of chapter 7, he spent some time in contrasts. This is good, but this is better. This is good, but this is better. They all have some value, but again, we have to focus on, or at least I'm focusing and taking you through my focus on things I wanted to go through with Ecclesiastes. So we're going to, in chapter 7, we're going to read verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. Again, that same idea again, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Again, wisdom that he's imparting to anyone who wants to read this book. Remember that everything, both sorrow and success, comes from God. That it's all part of his purpose. I look at this as Solomon saying, you know, I thought that the only way my life could have value was if I was happy. If everything was great, then you know, my life was right. I was on the right path. I was doing what I should do that was best for me. And he's realizing again that there's more to life, that even sorrow has its place. Even sorrow has a place in our life, and even sorrow can come from God. And I'll just throw a plug in for the movie Inside Out, because that was one of the messages from that movie, and it's a cool little, you think it's a kid's movie, but it's not really a kid's movie, so. That there's a point in sorrow, that all of us need to be able to express that, and mature people do have sorrow in their life, and they learn how to handle it and become strong from it. So Solomon just says, remember that God gives both, and they all come from God, and they all have a point. And I'm just jumping through because I want to, when he makes statements like that, that's a lot of what I'm trying to point out is his thought process as he got himself back to be right with God. He recognizes those things, and he wants part of that wisdom that he's giving and recording in this is for us to remember those things as well. So then, I'm going to skip through quite a few verses here. We're going to jump into chapter 8, and actually jump into toward the end of chapter 8. We're going to pick this up in verse 14, chapter 8, and read through verse 17. There is a vanity that occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked, and there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this was vanity. So he's saying, there's a truth in the world that good people get treated like bad, get the rewards that the bad people should get, and bad people get the rewards that the good people should get. And Solomon said, I thought that was wrong. That was futile. I said that this was also futile. This was also purposeless. This was also vanity. So I commended, in verse 15, I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun to do than eat, drink, and be merry, for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun. heart to know wisdom and see the business that is done on the earth, even though no one sees nor sleeps day or night. Then I saw all the work of God. So I said, I saw these things, and my first response was, like I said, my first response was, that's wrong. It shouldn't be that way. But as he started to apply wisdom and bringing God back into the picture, I saw all of the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. And he's talking about you can't understand God's purpose, all the work done under the sun, all the things that God does. That you can't understand God's purpose in everything that happens in life. Sometimes it doesn't seem to make sense. But if you believe, if you know God is there, there is a purpose in it. And that's what he's recognizing as he gains understanding again. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. His wisdom that he's stating right here is, don't expect everything that God does to make sense to you. We have those other scriptures, the ways of God are far above us. Man cannot understand the ways of God. For us as Christians, the foundation has to be a faith that God is working in your life. That God knows each one of us. That God is active in each one of our lives. That he's working to make our life, as each one of us as individuals, the best life that it can be. As far as we will take it to. And he's telling people, don't expect. If you believe that, don't expect everything to make sense still, because there's a trial that will come that won't make any sense. You will be that righteous, that good person that has the reward of the bad person that comes your way. More often than the other way around, hopefully, because we are supposed to be quite as bad as the rest of the world. But those things will happen. And he's saying, don't expect that to make sense all the time, but know that God is still there and that it's part of his plan for you and that he will work it out to the best for you. And if you've been in the church long, I think you can look at things in your life that are that way, that follow that path where it didn't really make sense. And you certainly didn't want to be suffering at that time. You didn't want to have to go through what you did, but look, you can look back on it and see that good things came from it, that there was good fruit that came from it. And that's really what Solomon is saying. Then we're going to go to chapter 9. And we'll pick up the book in chapter 7. Or verse 7, I'm sorry. Chapter 9, verse 7. Go, eat your bread with joy. And drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white. Let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, pointless life, which he has given you under the sun, all of your days of vanity. For that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. And there's a lot of discussion in the commentaries about exactly what God's trying to say, or what Solomon was trying to say right there. But all of them do point to the fact that he's still saying, the physical life doesn't mean that much. Your physical life isn't that good. Enjoy what you can. Get along, love your wife. Great advice there. Live happily, even better advice, live happily with the woman that you love all the days of your life. But one of the things that I liked best, the New Literal Translation had translated the second part of this in a way that I thought was good, and maybe sheds a little bit of light on Solomon's state of mind when he wrote this, but it's verse 9 in the New Literal Translation reads, live happily with the woman you love all the meaningless days of your life that God has given you, But then he says, the wife God gives you is your reward for your hard work. Which is a nice thing that, you know, God gives us our mates as a reward for the things we have to suffer in life. I thought that was kind of a good thing. So that's the best translation that I could find of what was going on in verse 9. Verse 10, whatever your hand, this is one of the more familiar scriptures in all of Ecclesiastes, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might. So he says, don't give up. Don't give up. Whatever you decide to do, you still should work at it. You still should work hard at it. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you're going. Work hard and enjoy those fruits, but just remember, you can't take it with you. There's no wisdom, there's no knowledge, there's nothing in the grave that you can take with you when you're going. Verse 11, and I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, the battle to the strong, nor the battle to the strong. Bread doesn't always go to the wise, or riches to the men of understanding, nor favor to the men of skill. But time and chance happens to them all. You don't always, again, he's just making the point, you don't always get what you think you deserve. You don't always get the rewards you think, the pay that you think you should get for what the things that you do. That isn't the way that things work. But he said just before that, still, you should work. But just remember, you have to enjoy the work for its own self, not because of what you think you might get from it. Because it doesn't always work out the way that you think it's going to. You may put in those 60, 70-hour weeks for years and years at work thinking you're going to get that promotion, and the promotion might just not come to you. So if you're going to work 60 or 70 hours, do it strictly because you think that that's what you should do, not because of what you think it's going to get you in the future. Work for its own sake. And then verse 13. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with few men in it, and a great king came against it, besieged it, and brought great snares around it. Now there was found in that city a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor wise man. No one remembered the savior of the city. Verse 16, then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard, rather than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Again, it's a little lesson that he's throwing out there again. It's a little lesson from the teacher. He says, most of the time, the people that get recognition, or the people that are listened to, aren't necessarily the ones that you should listen to. The person that's yelling the loudest, the shout of the ruler of fools, is the one that people listen to a lot of the time, rather than that wise person who's quietly giving good advice in the background. And you can see that in the world, you can see that in politics, you can see that everywhere. Whoever shouts the loudest, well, they've got to know what they're talking about. Whoever says something dogmatically has got to be the one that really knows the truth. Not the quiet person. You don't listen to them as much because they're not yelling. And I wrote in my notes that what he's saying is there's a difference between being opinionated and being knowledgeable. And that's a great lesson for all of us to remember. Just because someone forcefully expresses their opinion doesn't mean they're knowledgeable in the subject they're giving their opinion on. we should try to recognize the difference. And don't just go to the person who yells the loudest for advice. Look to that person who maybe is a little quieter, maybe is more in the background, but when you talk to them, if you ever ask them for advice, they give you good advice. So now let's skip a few more verses, and we'll go to chapter 10, and we'll pick it up in verse 5, because I think it's kind of a continuation of the thought that we just read. Chapter 10, verse 5. There is an evil I've seen under the sun, as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, while the rich sit in lowly places. I've seen servants on horses, while princes walk on the ground like servants. Be careful about someone who makes something stupid, folly, look like it's this great and noble thing. Folly's made to appear like it's a dignity, like it's a noble thing to do, where really the thing that's being presented is foolish. And he says, you know, I've seen servants on horses. In other words, I've seen someone who really deserved to be a servant be the one that's up on the horse above everybody else. And I've seen someone who should have been the ruler or the prince that was down, was lowly. Again, people, the station in life that you get in this physical world doesn't necessarily mean anything. It isn't what you deserve. It isn't how God sees you. Be aware that just because someone's in an exalted position doesn't mean that that's where God sees them. And we certainly hope that's not the case in the church, but in the world, it's certainly something to be concerned about. And also be aware that those small people, and I think this applies to the church, be aware that those small people, the ones that appear small, I should say, the ones that are in the background, the ones that are quiet, the ones that aren't the ones that everybody notices, they may actually be higher in God's sight. They may actually be pleasing God more. That goes that, you know, where Christ talked about the widow giving a better offering than the rich man who was throwing a shower on all of his wealth around. It is kind of right along the lines of what Solomon was saying, that just recognize that appearances can be deceiving. Appearances can be deceiving. That's probably the best way to sum up what the point he's trying to make. Now we'll jump to chapter 11. Read a few verses there. I'm going to start in verse 4 of chapter 11. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. So we're saying, somebody who stands there looking at the wind, looking to see which direction the wind is coming from, looking to see what weather might be coming their way, isn't actually sowing anything. You're just looking at the weather. You haven't started to do anything. He who regards the clouds will not reap. Same thing. If you're looking, you're not doing, is kind of what he's saying. And then he continues, as you do not know what is the way of the wind, or in other words, you don't understand weather. You can't predict the weather, or how bones grow in the womb of her that's with child, in the same way that you can't understand how a baby actually grows inside of its mother. So you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning, sow your seed. In the evening, don't withhold your hand. The inference there is the reap, going back to the reaping that he talked about in verse 4. For you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, whether both the like will be good. One of the commentaries that I read said that this is referring to sowing a wide variety of seed. In other words, try to grow a lot of different things because you don't know what's going to actually grow, what's actually going to produce. again, the message in this verse, or these verses that he's giving us, is if you wait for the perfect time to do something, you'll probably never find it. You know, and a lot, I think those who came into the church as an adult or came in later in life, a lot of times when you talk to people like that, they were waiting to be a little bit more perfect before they decided to be baptized. Waiting for something special, for one more hurdle to pass. And Solomon is saying, if you know something needs to be done, don't wait for the perfect time to do it, because the perfect time will never come and then you'll never do it. Just do what you need to do. Work around, you know, there may be obstacles, the weather may not be great. But do, if you know that it needs to be done, do it. And again, the good advice for all of us, those of you who have any perfectionist characteristics in your blood, you always wait. Because there's always something that you think you can maybe have you can prepare a little bit more, do a little bit better. Or you don't want to get started because it won't be perfect, and so you're going to wait until maybe something else changes and you can make it perfect. So obviously I'm speaking from experience with this part of it. So, but it's a good lesson to remember. If you know it has to be done, just do it. Get started on it. Don't wait. Then verse 9 of chapter 11, we'll read another section of scriptures. Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and young women, let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. You know, we're getting near the end of his lesson. We're getting near the end of everything he's written. And he's kind of going back to his life and his youth and saying, young people, don't be afraid to enjoy life. Walk in the ways of your heart. But, and that's where he got lost as a young person. But remember that you will stand before God in judgment for all of those things that you do, whether you were young. Saying, oh, I was young, really isn't an excuse for doing stupid things if you know better. Verse 10, therefore remove sorrow from your heart, put away evil from your flesh. Childhood and youth are vanity. Remember, chapter 12, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come and the years draw near, when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Again, he's speaking from experience. He's saying, young people, even in your youth, don't forget God. Because I did. And what it led me to was that as when the years drew near, I said, you would say, I have no pleasure in them. While the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are not darkened and the clouds do not return from the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men bow down. He's talking about as you get older. He's describing aging in ways where I guess he's trying to be nice, but he's talking about basically how all of you, you know, your body gets old. Your body starts to get tired. And he's saying, remember God now. Don't wait until you get old, until you're starting to, until you're closer to death. Remember your Creator. Verse 6, he says, remember your Creator before the silver cord is loose, before you die. Remember God. And again, he's thankful that he did have that opportunity to come back to God. But it's a good lesson for young people. Then he says, don't let the excitement of youth, the experience of youth, the newness of starting your life lead you to forget about your Creator. Always keep that there. Then he starts to be really we're getting to the end of his lesson, and he starts to kind of summarize the things that he's written. Verse 8 says, "Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs." The preacher, and I'm not sure exactly, he uses the preacher, and he just continues that this is a third-person account. Solomon is the preacher. The preacher sought to find acceptable words. He said, I've thought about what I wrote. I've thought about all the things I've written. This isn't just a stream of consciousness blog of mine that I wrote whatever came to mind. I thought about what I was going to say and about the lesson I wanted to give. And what was written, verse 10, what was written was upright. What I ended up with, what's left, what I left here for you, is good. It's good. And they are words of truth. He said, the words of the wise are like goads, prods, something that pushes us forward, spurs us on. He's saying, the words that I've given you, if you read these things, if you think about what I've written, it should spur you on to do something different. The words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. Verse 12, and further, my son, be admonished by these. Be admonished. Learn the lessons. Learn my lessons so you don't have to repeat them. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. And what he's saying here is, this is where truth is. There's a lot of books out there. There's a lot of other people that you could go to for their opinions on the things I've written about. But this is truth. You can always find other people that will tell you some other perspective. You will always find some other people, something else that someone else has written that they think is the truth on this subject. But it's here, you know, Solomon is saying, this is where wisdom is, this is where truth is, and what I've written about these things. Verse 13 and 14, I think, probably, again, some of the more familiar verses in Ecclesiastes. But it's the one final truth that he wants to leave with everyone who is part of his class. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. The conclusion of the matter, the way to live your life, the right way to live your life, isn't all of those things I tried to do, all of those ways that I thought would maybe give my life meaning that I thought I was missing. The conclusion of the matter is fear God and keep his commandments. That will give you the life that is the most productive. That will give you the life that is the most satisfying. That will give you the life that leads you to a happiness that isn't vain and futile, to things that are permanent. We hear those words and we understand the words, but I know I find in my life so many times I still don't really practice them as much as I should, the way that I should. And I don't want to just, I'm not trying to just read over those and let them just kind of drift off into the background because we've read them a lot of times. Fear God and keep his commandments, and that is all of our duty. Pretty wise words from the wisest man that ever lived. Solomon started out on a quest in this book to understand the meaning of life, why he was here, what was his purpose, and he used his wealth and his power and his intellect in that search to pursue that goal, but he used it without God. At the beginning, he used it without any influence from God, just what he thought. And he learned number of truths as he looked back. I'm sure he was thankful at this point in his life that he could still look back, and that he was still alive, and that he was able to then share those with people. And this book is here because the wisdom in it applies to every one of us. It doesn't matter that it was written thousands of years ago. And wisdom, again, it's certainly been a focus on my mind over the last month or two. Having wisdom and having the right kind of wisdom is so important to us as Christians. And Solomon ended up with the right kind of wisdom. So I hope that you have, you know, thought about the things, wrote some things down, or at least made mental notes about some of the things, the lessons that Solomon was trying to teach. In the end, he realized that the thing that would last, the only thing of importance was his relationship with God. The whole conclusion, the whole duty of his whole duty, his whole conclusion to what would make his life right was to fear God and keep his commandments. That applies to us at every stage of our life. So hopefully we think about what Solomon has given us, what Solomon shared with us, the wisdom that he's passed on to us. Hopefully all of us find ways that it's relevant in our life. Solomon said at the start, "Hear the words of the preacher." God inspired that to be left for us. So the question, as we finish this message, for each one of us is, will I hear the words of the preacher? Will I apply it in my own life? Hear the words of the preacher.